So this idea that, like, we don't have, like, the brain power, the community power, intelligence to, like, think of other ways that we're going to evaluate children is really flawed, and it's in service, again, to white supremacy.
Yo, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And here in our Harlem studio, the Immigrant Studio, we have two powerful women. Rima Amin is a reporter at Chalkbeat, New York. Hey, Rima, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also joining us in the studio is my tocaya, which is Mexican for namesake. So that means her name is Maria Bautista.
Surprise.
Surprise. Campaigns director at Alliance for Quality Education right here in New York City. Welcome to the show, tocaya.
Hey, hey, fam.
But where are you from? What's your...
Yo soy Dominicana.
So tocaya doesn't mean anything to you.
Or I mean, it does.
Yes,
just
no,
because
I
learned it in high school, but it's not like we often say, oh, tú eres mi tocaya.
So she's Dominican, I'm Mexican, and now we're like sisters. And we're talking about education and how difficult it is in a city like New York City, one of the most diverse, right? And so some numbers have come out in New York that have been pretty shocking. So let me just quickly, for our listener who's like, well, wait, what, New York? Okay, so there's something in New York called the specialized high schools. And these are public high schools that you have to test in. So, for example, my son tested in and got into one of these specialized high schools. It wasn't the top number one. The number one specialized high school is Stuyvesant.
That's right.
Rima, just give us the numbers of what happened in terms of the admissions into Stuyvesant in one of the most diverse cities.
That's right.
Give us the numbers.
So every year they release data that shows the public where offers to these specialized high schools go. And for folks who don't know what these schools are, they're considered among the most elite schools, not only in New York City, but by some measures across the country.
Bronx Science.
Right.
That's right.
Brooklyn Tech.
Yeah, Bronx Science.
Stuyvesant.
Right. Stuyvesant, Brooklyn Tech. I mean, these, like, people know them around the world.
That's right. Like, they produce Nobel laureates. You know, they're regarded as places where if you want to be successful in the future, many people consider them as the first stop. So in the most recent data that was released, out of 895 offers to Stuyvesant for next school year for the freshman class, 7 Black students received offers.
Jesus.
Out of 900, you have 7 Black students getting an offer.
Wow.
That's right.
Wow.
In the freshman year.
I mean, overall, admissions to specialized high schools, 10% of these admissions went to Black and Hispanic students, while they make up a majority of the population of city students across the city. And at the same time, 51% offers went to students from Asian American families. It's those numbers that, you know, that sort of stark segregation that has fueled this debate. And I mean, this debate around specialized high schools has been going on for years and years. But every year, this data is released, and every year, the same conversation happens.
Okay, I bet some people were thinking that the 51% that you were going to say was going to be white.
So about 29% of offers to specialized high schools went to white students, who only make up about 15% of the city student demographic. It's also not representative of how many white students are actually among citywide students.
So for you, what is the headline of those numbers? Like, what are people supposed to take away when they hear those numbers? What do you want them to take away?
All of us who cover this issue want people to take away the fact that the racial demographics at some of the most elite schools in the city and the country do not represent the racial demographics of students citywide. That when you walk into a school building, into an elite school like Stuyvesant, the student body is not going to look like the student body in the city. It's not representative of what New York City looks like. That's what I think all of us want people to understand.
And what's representative, so people know that the public school population in New York City of Black and Latino students is about 70%.
That's right.
Right. So
right.
So if you have 10% of high school students who are Black and Latino, like, I mean, there it is right there. There's the problem. But I mean, this has been an issue that's been going for decades. But Maria, our education advocate, not Maria the journalist.
I was like, wait, you're going to ask me a question? She's like, no.
Yeah, I'm going to have to, like, how do I do this? Dominicana Maria Dominicana.
It's me.
What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts about all these numbers and what comes to,
as
what,
an
you
activist.
Know, what do you think about all this?
You know, if I were to headline it, I would be like, this is what racism looks like. And I think oftentimes we dance around what this is. And I think if we don't name it, then we can't get to the core of what the problem is. And the problem is that there was an act specifically, the legislation was driven by a group of white parent activists that wanted to maintain their privilege and access to these schools. And they changed the admissions to a sole test to leave out the Black and Puerto Rican students at the time. And so if we don't name that, if we don't call it, if we don't put our fingers on it, we're actually doing this in injustice. Mm-hmm. And this is what this is about. This, for me, is about equity and access. And I wish that we would spend more time talking about that. I think that this debate around the Shazat, or the what people call the
SHSAT, which is the Specialized yeah. High School yeah. SAT, again, this yeah. test that you have to take for a public school.
It's the tip of the iceberg. You know, I think it's just a larger manifestation of what white supremacy looks like in New York State and across the country.
Call it.
And how we're leaving behind Black and brown communities. And so for me, you know, I do a lot of work around having a more equitable education system. And a large part of our work is around fully funding public schools. And for years around the Campaign for Fiscal Equity, an old lawsuit that we fought for and won in 2006, and it still hasn't been honored by New York State. New York State owes our public schools $4 billion. The majority of that money is owed to Black and brown communities. So in every which way, we're leaving behind Black and brown community members, and we need to call out what's at the roots of all of this in order to start moving towards justice.
And so for you, the root is kind of structural racism that has been imposed and consistently imposed
and accepted.
Yes.
I just have one question about this, because we're hearing the numbers, but what's the pushback as well? Because obviously these numbers are ridiculous. I think there's a bigger question here about racial disparity in public schools around the country. But what are people, how are people defending this? I want to know who the hell's defending this.
Well, I think first of all, like, it's important to understand, to get into these high schools, you have to take a test. It's a single admissions exam.
It's like a 3 or 4 hour test with there's a major yeah. writing component, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. And so you got to get this cutoff score depending on which school you're going to. And that's how you get in. So the argument has been the city, you know, is proposing to get rid of the exam completely, which experts have said this single exam is what is helping keep these schools starkly segregated by race. Mm-hmm. So the city has said, OK, let's get rid of the exam. And what we'll do instead is we will admit the top 7% of students at each middle school. And that in itself will immediately begin to diversify these schools. And it's a plan that mm-hmm. would phase in slowly over the next, you know, few years. So here, you know, some argue that the city can immediately start working on this plan, but there's argument over what, you know, state lawmakers can do. The bigger issue here is that state lawmakers need to change the law to get rid of this exam at least some of the schools.
And three so that's of the schools.
That's three of the schools. That's right. And so the city has argued they just want state lawmakers to get rid of it so that the exam is gone for all the schools and it can just be in one big sweep. So the pushback against this is coming from advocates who want to keep the exam, who argue that this single exam is race blind. And many of the advocates who are behind this push are Asian American families who feel that they're being unfairly targeted, that their students are receiving a majority of the offers.
Well, that was the white elephant in the room, frankly.
And a lot of people...
Weird, bad word, weird. Yeah, like all around, but yes.
That's sort of the pushback here. And, you know, one of the most striking things I've found about this debate is at the core of this is who has access to test prep? Who has the money for that? Who has the time for that? And many times it is wealthier, affluent, white families. But there are Asian families who have argued that, listen, there are many low-income...
And they put in the work.
Well, they say that they'll sacrifice, they will get extra jobs, they will do whatever they need to. But that argument assumes that families of other races
don't
want
that.
To do that or don't do that.
Right.
Anyway, I think I'm going on a tangent here, but
it's
super layered.
No, I think it's interesting.
It's complicated.
I was just curious about the pushback. It makes it complex. It's complicated, Maria Hinojosa, right?
It is. But before me, I want to hear about Maria Batista and what she thinks about this. Like, you said straight up, you were like, look, this is what racism looks like. And I'm sure there were some people who were listening who were like, well, wait a second. It's 51% Asian. Black and brown are definitely facing a challenge here. But how is this talked about within the communities that you're working with, which are diverse, that include African-American, Latino, and Asian? So how is that conversation being had, for example, within the educational activist community? Because what happens in New York and the conversations and how they happen in New York ultimately are going to impact what happens in the rest of the country.
You know, I think that this conversation we just started having with a couple of organizations that we consider allies. And one of the organizations is serving Asian American families. And the way that we're talking about this is that we need to be allies in this fight. Literally, we are fighting for scraps. Mm-hmm. 2,000 Asian children got into these schools out of the 8,000 Asian children that took the test. And so this isn't serving anyone, because the reality is many of them are also low income and poor like us. And so they're investing in this system. They're sometimes getting cheated. You know, a lot of these companies take advantage of these families, that you're talking about children having to sacrifice art, music, and the sciences for this test, that you're talking about all of these sacrifices that families are making. And at the end of the day, that it's a divide and conquer strategy, right? That there's so little for Black and brown communities that we are constantly fighting each other for scraps, when the reality is that all children in every single community can have a high quality education. Why is it that we don't have Stuyvesants in every single community that can anchor all of our children? And the reality is that we can have that,
that
there's no will to do it. There's no political will to do it.
So you're basically saying, Maria, like, we've all become kind of accustomed to accepting this structure. And I love the way that you're like, why can't we have Stuyvesant high schools in all of our communities? Whether there's one in Harlem, there can be one on the Upper West Side, there can be one on the South Bronx.
Yeah. I mean, it's a rhetorical question on my end. I'm like, it's not in the service of capitalism. That's why.
Damn, she's bringing receipts.
What Maria just said is something that AOC had said at a town hall recently.
And he loved his experience at Brooklyn Tech because he went to a good school. My question is, Why are there only five or a handful of schools in New York City that are putting together the test? And my question is, why isn't every public school in New York City a Brooklyn Tech caliber school? Everyone should be.
You were there.
I was there. They were like, it's Asian racism. I'm like,
there were a few Asian protesters in the back that when the specialized high schools issue came up, it was just one question. A few protesters got up in the back, held up signs and said, you know, this is racism. They were advocating again to keep the test. And so it was a mini scene, but it showed the intensity of the moment right now around this conversation. And
I know, I was just curious what our Maria, our guest, thought of what AOC, since you said you were there, what she said, and does it align with what you're thinking? I mean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, before she spoke, I was the first person to address the question. And the question was, you know, basically, does the test make this fair? Or something to that effect. And I was like, no, you know, this doesn't make it fair. It doesn't level the playing field. That was a question. Does it level the playing field? Absolutely not. And for us as an organization, what we've been doing is fighting for these billions of dollars that are owed to our public schools. And while people are like, oh, you know, money doesn't make things equitable. Yes, as the people that have money, right? who are you trying to play?
They're like, we've never had a problem with equity. And it's like, that's because you're rich, yo.
And, you know, there was a study
that came out. Why don't you give us some money to prove it? Right.
Right. So there was a study that came out about 2 months ago, like right smack in the middle of our budget session at the state level. And they showed that white districts get $23 billion more than Black and brown districts. Now, you tell me that money doesn't matter. You tell me that money doesn't matter in communities that are poor, communities where the majority of the children are English language learners, where you have, you know, special needs students. And so if you look and compare, let's say, a Peekskill in New York State, like in Westchester County, and Scarsdale, both in Westchester County, and the amount of resources that Scarsdale was getting, and they have a fraction of the need that Peekskill does, what are we doing? We are setting up a system that those that have will continue to have and that those that don't will not, right? And so I think in terms of leveling the playing field, what we really need to do is start taking into account what's happening at the local school districts, funding those needs, and really branching out to make sure that the communities have the supports they need in order for all children to have a high-quality education.
Hey, welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa. With me is my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. This week, we're joined by Rima Amin and Maria Bautista. We're going to jump back into the conversation. I love what you're saying in the sense of getting rid of the test. But what do you say to people who just say, well, how are we going to judge then? Rima.
That's the exact question that is happening on the local level. I mean, that is the exact question. And that's the thing. Like, that's the thing. And, I just want to speak from the perspective of being a South Asian woman who's first generation here.
Yeah.
My parents came to this country. My parents are from India. I'm Indian. They came to this country in the 70s and 80s. And that was a long time ago. And I had a comfortable childhood. We never faced real difficulty or anything like that. Even so, getting into a good college and bringing home A's and doing whatever you could to prep for it was just part of our experience. And I'm speaking from a personal experience here because I think the story for many immigrants, at least from that region, you do so much. You bust ass to get to this country.
True.
And so when you get here, you want to do what you perceive as shooting for the stars. So if that means doing whatever you can to prep for this single test that gets you into one of the best high schools in the country, chances are you're going to do it. So I wonder if there's so many elements to this debate, and I hope that people understand that that's probably something at play here as well. And so to go back to your question, though, like, that is exactly why there are advocates from the Asian American community. And also to note, there are many people in the Asian American community who want to eliminate the test along with the city. They believe in this pathway to diversifying the schools. But keeping the test, that is their, it's an attainable goal.
It's like a number.
Maria, our guest, what's your story? I'm just curious.
Now that we know Rima's.
Your education story.
Sure. But before we go to that, I just want to go back and say that when we rely on tests, we are really relying on someone's idea of what success is, someone's idea of what it is. Like, basically, what we're measuring is what somebody else thinks is intelligence or being smart. And oftentimes, let's be clear, it's not how smart you are, it's access to resources. And so this idea that tests are race blind is really flawed, in that, like, to continue to operate using tests, and let's be clear, we use tests at every level. From third to eighth grade, we're testing Black and brown children. The majority of our children aren't doing well on these
tests. We're testing kids in early education. We're testing 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds, and it's not even elementary school.
And
it's
even before
then. And
they're walking around thinking they're ones and twos. Yeah. And what that does, like, that happened to you in high school. But when you have a generation of children that are walking around thinking that they're ones and twos, what does that do psychologically to a child? And so this idea that, like, we don't have, like, the brain power, the community power, intelligence to, like, think of other ways that we're going to evaluate children is really flawed, and it's in service, again, to white supremacy. And I'm just going to say, again, like, how do we measure people holistically? A test captures maybe a fraction of who you are. Like, we can move away towards portfolios that better capture how you're doing in reading, your progress, all of that. And so I feel like I just really want to echo that point, because it's really important in terms of, like, what we are doing to communities. Yeah. It's not just stressful. It's like psychological warfare.
Right.
So
I see my 16-year-old. I mean, I live in a privileged suburb, but I see my 16-year-old in a high-performing public school. And there's days, you know, they track his grade every day. We can track his grade online every day. And he's like, please don't track my grade every day.
That sounds horrible.
It is horrible. Jeez.
He's like, this is the worst thing ever created for the school district is to track my grade by the hour.
What I say to Julio is like, soon it will be over because you have no idea how thankful I am that my kids went through school in New York City and all of the testing and that they made it out. I am so done with the testing insanity. I was done with it from the beginning because of my trauma. But Maria, we want to hear your story. Your family is Dominican. So what's your education story?
So I want to start by saying that I have parents that came from Dominican Republic in the 80s. My father, you know, after years of not sharing this, had shared that he only had a fifth grade education and that he only had a fifth grade education because, you know, he had to walk to school. He's from Acampo, which means he's from the countryside in Dominican Republic. Really no access to education. My mother has an eighth grade education. And so for my father, it was such a priority for us to get a high quality education. And so we went to a Catholic school all our lives. And I think that...
So where was that?
In Queens. Okay. In Queens, New York. Boop, boop. In Jackson Heights. Yes.
Jackson Heights. Queens, oh, my Queens. God. The best food yes. ever in the world.
I'm like, everyone's day is playing Queens. And so you go and have food.
Yeah.
And I think that what was really wonderful about my experience is that I had access to resources. Really, what I had was access to whiteness. Mm, and whoa. All my teachers were white from first to high school. My first black teacher was in the 11th grade. And so while I had all this access to whiteness and resources, what I didn't have was a sense of who I was. I didn't have a sense that people of color were people that could be in positions of power. I didn't have a sense that my community was respected or honored. And so I think that in addition to having the privilege, and I think that that's something that I've always walked with, you're right, we absolutely have tons of privilege. I have a master's, but I'm one in a few in a family that's so large and broad that has access to this, that has a master's. And so you start asking, why is it that I'm the only one? Am I special? I absolutely am not special. I think that there's so much brilliance in my family. It's how are we fostering that brilliance? So I think two things that...
Wait a second. You just got emotional. Am I right?
I'm always emotional. I'm a hot mess.
You're I think you were about to cry.
No, you know, it bubbles up because I'm profoundly passionate about this because I walk in these communities every day. And the sense that, like, our communities don't matter. I know that. Like, I know that that is what's happening. And I know the brilliance. I know the warmth. I know all of the things that we
Their
bring.
Their capacity, God, like creativity, so survival, coño. Like,
you talk about it. This is it, you know?
Right.
And that we are not fostering that intentionally is just heartbreaking and devastating. And I think that it really fuels my, like, energy. Like, sometimes I want to throw in the towel, and I'm like, you do not have the privilege to throw in the towel, right? Like, you've been armed with this information. You cannot turn away from this.
I love the fact that you said, like, access to whiteness, which kind of blew my mind right there. Because you're right. I mean, we don't see ourselves in public education, even though, especially in New York City, it's so racially diverse. And one of the things that you advocate for is this culturally responsive education bill. So can you just explain why that's important? Because what I want to know is, like, the day-to-day classroom, what's happening right now? Why do you think we need to have this culturally responsive education bill because of the things that you see day-to-day in these classrooms?
You know, the first time I saw myself reflected in the curriculum was in the fifth grade. And I remember it so vividly because we were talking about Hispaniola, but it was within the context that's Dominican Republic and ID. But we were talking about it within the context of Columbus. And I was like, oh, hell fucking no. Like, we are not talking about the people that I know and love through the context. And
because even though you were in fifth grade as a Dominican, like, you knew that, wait, you can't just talk about Columbus.
It's deep.
Hold up.
Yeah, it's deep.
Right. This rapist. You are not going to talk about him while we're talking about Dominican Republic. And like I said this before, all my teachers were white. And so internally, like, I really felt that I couldn't be a teacher. I couldn't be in a position of power because of that. I think another profound moment, I was in the first or second grade, and I was talking to a compañera, a classmate, in Spanish. And one of the teachers pulls me over and says, this is America.
No.
We don't talk that.
What
we
year
don't
are we?
Speak what, this here.
What year?
I was 6 years old. I was born in 85. Oh, my God.
Okay, so and early...
I was part of the
Okay, so early... So early 1990s, yes. basically. Okay. So early 1990s, you guys.
Yes.
You?
So also I was an English language learner. Part of the process of being an English language learner was that a group of us had to leave the classroom, walk outside of the school, and walk onto a bus. And people would make fun of us. They're like, oh, there go the stupid kids, or there go the kids that don't know how to speak English. And I just remember that so profoundly and how it impacted me. And it wasn't until the first Black teacher that I had was in 11th grade, the first book that I read that was by a Latina was in the 11th grade.
What book was that?
Isabel Allende, I forget which book it was, but you know,
Casa de los Espíritus.
Casa de los Espíritus.
And it was like, why did I have to wait so long to feel like there are trickles of me that matter in this curriculum? And so I had the opportunity to go to other schools, but I just decided to go to the City College of New York. You know, right up the block from here. And it was the best decision of my life. It really was where I started to heal and put myself back together. All of my teachers were predominantly people of color. Or women, and all of my teachers were coming from the left, and really put into perspective that Dominicans aren't here just to be here, that Dominicans are here because the United States invaded Dominican Republic in 1965, and that's when you start to see the large flood of Dominicans, right? And that really helped put me into place, that really helped me figure out, what was I doing here? What are some of the contributions that my people have made? And really opened up the doors to me understanding like why culturally responsive education is so important. And this is still going on. You know, we've been doing these curriculum scorecards that are being done by Metro Center at NYU. And it's unbelievable, right? Like they score the curriculums from culturally responsive to culturally destructive. And the majority of the curriculums that we've been able to score are culturally destructive.
Whoa.
And so this is why in this moment, especially under this leadership that's moving us towards fascism and that has bred all of this hate.
So close.
We're so there. We're at the
brink. Are we there yet?
I don't know. I don't know yet. I feel like we're at the brink. But it's so important to talk about our cultures and our histories in our classrooms, and not just from diversity. Like, that's what we used to do back then. Oh, you're a Dominican, you bring in a Dominican plate, you're Salvadorian, bring in your dress. But really from a perspective of, like, honoring people's cultures, yes, we see you, but also then getting at the nitty-gritty, the deeper roots, right? Like, how are we really addressing racism? How are we addressing the status quo and oppression so that we are all liberated, right? Like, that's what I see as culturally responsive education, and like why we're in this space and time where we really need to do it and do it well.
Let's move on to our final segment, which we call Sin Pendejadas, or basically, no bullshit.
So in the question of no bullshit, and kind of in a historical context now, how far have we actually come in terms of equity in public education? Would we say that right now, a first-generation immigrant girl is luckier to go through our school system now than, for example, just 10 years ago or 20 years ago? Like, can we measure that? What do you think, Rima?
That's a good question. My first inkling would be to look at data that looks like academic outcomes, which is often dictated by like state test scores. And my thinking would be yes, but it's complicated. If you're a first generation immigrant, let's say, and English is your first language, right? Or English is going to be the new language that you are learning in this system. The data shows right now that those students, a majority of English language learners, at least let's say in New York City, for example, are not doing well academically. Mm. And a lot of that is tied to what is happening in the classroom, what sort of supports they're receiving. Are the teachers who are teaching them understand how English language learners acquire language? These are the questions that still exist. The difference now, I think, is that the system is attempting to address that issue. Whereas 20 years ago, I don't know if that even mattered. I think that's a big part of it. So I would say, yes, probably, but the data shows that there is a very long way to go to ensure the success of, let's say, a first generation young girl who is coming from another country.
You know what I would say? At least now we have a way to kind of talk about it. 20 years ago, there wasn't this first gen. Nobody knew what first generation.
Yeah.
Like, nobody would be like, what? It wasn't called English language learning. It was English as a second language without understanding that people spoke multiple languages, which is why it's now called English language learning. So there are you know, a little bit of progress, I guess. But Maria, bring it home.
I think there are glimmers of hope within our system. I just want to say, one, we're educating people for the status quo, especially in Black and brown communities. And, like, I really want to see education move us to how do we educate children holistically? And how are we educating children, or what I like to call, like, education for liberation, right? Like, how are we deeply educating students to fulfill their whole potential, I think is something that I often think about. And what role does the education system play within that? I think that in terms of, you know, progress, where we still have a long, long way to go, is how are we fully funding our public schools, addressing segregation, the school-to-prison pipeline, which is alive and well, and how we're pushing Black and brown students out of our schools and into jails.
School-to-prison or school-to-immigration detention facility,
yes,
to,
you
know what I'm saying?
Yes. There's a pipe.
There's that
you.
Pipeline, too.
Yes,
right?
And they're all alive and well. And so I think that, yes, while there are glimmers of hope, I think that there's so much work that we need to do in order to address the gaps that we have, which aren't academic gaps. We're not measuring, you know, like, our academics. What we're measuring is resource gaps. And I want to be really clear about that, like, that we need to address that resource gap in order for us to, like, really address the system. And I think just structurally how we've set up the system, like, I wonder, does it foster, like, real love of learning, right? Like, being in a classroom, studying for a test, like, that hard drill and kill of being in the classroom and, like, just, oh, I need to do good on this math test or this English test. Like, what does that do for the rest of the child, right? Like, that is really passionate about dancing or the arts or sciences, right? That we're leaving all of these components behind. And I think we need to figure out a system that, like, teaches the whole child.
Preach. All right. Maria Bautista, campaign director at Alliance for Quality Education, and Rima Amin, reporter with Chalkbeat New York. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this edition of
In the
Thick.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Uno, dos, tres.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
All right, dear listener, remember, you got to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. And, you know, since we were talking about education, give us the highest score, like 8++++. It really does help other listeners to find us. And remember, you can also listen to In the Thick on Pandora, on Spotify, wherever you choose to listen to your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell everyone you know to listen. In the Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnum and Nicole Rothwell. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Noor Saudi. The music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. We will see you on our next episode. Thank you so much for listening. We really do appreciate it, don't we, Julio?
We really do appreciate it.
So,
bye.
Bye. Ciao. Thank you.
Bye. Test, test. Wow, that's
really
good.
What kind of a bird is it? When you hear those birds going like that.
Oh, that's a crow.
In the spring. No, it's not a crow. It's not a crow. No. Which bird is this?
I have it in the middle of my...
It's like in the city?
Yes, mind. In the city.
Oh, in the city.
What are the birds?
A falcon.
I only can think of pigeons and crows.
Okay.
In the city.
Blue jay?
Not a pigeon. Who said blue jay?
Me.
Who's me?
Noor,
you got it.
Yay.
That sounds...
Noor is so New York.
That
New York,
is a blue jay. I Noor, used to think it was...
You know what would make a great show? Noor and Maria bird watching in New York City. Let's write that one down. Let's pitch it.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.